messianic prophecy. Amazing to me that most of our Bible colleges today do not offer a course in messianic prophecy. It used to be standard fare in every curriculum, but in recent years it sort of has fallen by the wayside. At best, you can maybe pick up an elective credit in some of the Bible colleges. But it's a fascinating subject, and as most of you know, I just a year or so ago completed a book for College Press. And I have to tell you that in researching that book, why I had to change some of my own views on some things that I've been taught in Bible college. And it's agonizing when you've taught something and believed it for years and years and years to be forced by a re-evaluation of the materials to change your mind. That's not pleasant. It's a humbling experience. But I enjoyed the study. And I don't know how many of those things I'll be able to share with you today, but I'll share what I can, and maybe we can leave some time. What time am I supposed to be finished here? So I stay on schedule, Milo.
10:45.
Well, since my watch says 12 o'clock, it's 10 o'clock here, right?
I'll let you know.
And it's supposed to be at 10:45. Okay. Let's start out with a scripture, and then I'll go down the outline for a while and depart therefrom for a while, and get back to some things here. Chapter 26 of the book of Acts, verses 1 through 7, Paul is standing before Agrippa. And says, then Agrippa said to Paul, you are permitted to speak for yourself. And then Paul stretched out his hand and proceeded to make his defense. In regard to all the things of which I am accused by the Jews, I consider myself fortunate, King Agrippa, that I am about to make my defense before you today, especially because you are an expert in all the customs and questions among the Jews. Therefore, I beg you to listen to me patiently. So then all the Jews know my manner of life from my youth up, which from the beginning was spent among my own nation and at Jerusalem. Since they have known about me for a long time previously, if they were willing to testify that I lived as a Pharisee according to the strictest sect of our religion. And now I am standing trial, get this next phrase, for the hope of the promise made by God to our fathers, the promise to which our 12 tribes hoped to attain as they earnestly serve God night and day. And for this hope, O King, I am being accused by the Jews. And so as Paul here evaluates why it is that the Jews are so antagonistic towards him, he summarizes their antagonism by saying, in effect, I don't understand it. Because what I'm being put on trial for today is the hope, the promise, the very thing that Israel has looked forward to all of these years. That's what I'm being put on trial for here today. Now, when you look at the New Testament, you'll find something like 40 New Testament passages that cite the word promise as the essence of Old Testament teaching. We want to know this problem of the continuity and discontinuity Brother Mott referred to. Well, here's part of the continuity, the idea of the promise finding fulfillment in the New Testament age and in the New Covenant. Now, there is but one promise. Paul uses the singular. A singular plan of God for bringing about blessing upon the whole earth. And yet this singular plan was made up of many specifications called promises in the plural. And I give you some references on that. Now, when you begin to check out these references in the New Testament in regard to the promise, you find that according to New Testament teaching, the Old Testament promise involves many things that are very basic to our Christian faith. The blessing for Gentiles through the gospel was part of the promise. People don't seem to understand that God's plan from the very beginning was to ultimately include the Gentiles. It's not a plan B on the part of God to include the Gentiles. It's plan A. And even under the Old Testament, any Gentile that wanted to embrace faith in the living God could do so. So the God of the Bible, the prophets are full of passages speaking about how God yearned for the salvation of the Gentiles. The Psalms are full of that. The prophets are full of that. It's always been part of God's promise. And the New Testament looks upon that promise as finding fruition in the preaching of the gospel of Christ. The doctrine of resurrection is associated with that Old Testament promise. The promise of the Holy Spirit is associated with this idea of promise from the Old Testament. The idea of redemption from sin, and most importantly, and the promise that I want to focus on today, although we could focus on any one of these, I want to focus upon the promise of Messiah. For that is the promise par excellence from the Old Testament, is that there is coming one who will redeem his people. Now, I want to depart momentarily from the outline that you have to share with you some other material, which I should have included. But this term Messiah is an interesting term. We use it quite a bit. In the King James Version, the term Messiah is used only twice in the New Testament. That is, in that exact spelling form. Twice in the Old Testament, in the book of Daniel, two times, in Daniel 9, 25 and 26. So the term Messiah does not even occur frequently in Jewish literature in the period immediately prior to the New Testament, strange to say. You can read the Apocrypha, for example, written in the century right before the time of Christ. You find practically no reference to the Messiah. That's a strange thing when you begin this study. But the Hebrew term Mashiach, which is translated Messiah, means the anointed one, is used 39 times in the Old Testament. Now, most writers on Messianic prophecy will assert that in none of those 39 cases is the word Mashiach or Messiah used of the coming one, the one we call Messiah, the deliverer anticipated in the Old Testament. My study, and I used to teach that too, but until I checked the sources and really dug into it, in my own study, I found at least 9 of those 39 times that the Hebrew term Mashiach is used, in my judgment, based upon my own exegesis of the passages, in reference to the coming one. I suppose there would be scholars that would disagree in every one of those paths. I know they would. But that was the fruit of my own study, and I really don't have to be responsible to anybody but myself in trying to interpret the passages as to satisfy my own mind as to what these passages are saying. Now, in the Old Testament times, as you all have learned, I'm sure, along the way, that we have prophets and priests and kings, most particularly priests and kings, that were anointed with oil. And maybe one case where you have a prophet anointed. But the idea of the anointed one suggests that the Messiah was to be the anointed one par excellence. He was to be prophet. He was to be king. He was to be priest. Under the Old Testament law, there was a rather rigid barrier between the kingship and the priesthood. But even the Old Testament prophets predicted the day when that distinction would be erased and the two offices would be combined in one person. This idea begins early in the Old Testament, but is stated very explicitly in the prophet Zechariah. Now, when you use the term messianic, it can be used in two ways. In the broadest possible sense, the entire Old Testament is messianic. All of its history, its devotional literature, the law itself, all of it's messianic in the sense of, in a general sense, of preparing the way for the coming of Christ. Use the term messianic to refer to what I call the golden age. Many Old Testament prophecies are referring to a golden age. And a little bit of this came out in the last session. There's quite a bit of dispute among people as to whether that golden age finds its fruition in the church age of which we are a part, or whether it looks forward to heaven, or whether to a millennium upon the earth. But you can use the term messianic for that golden age. But in the narrow definition, and that's the definition because of time limitations that I'm forced to use today, the narrow definition, is, when we talk about a messianic prophecy, we're talking about a passage that speaks directly about the person or work of Jesus. This is called personal messianic prophecy. Now, how many personal messianic prophecies are there in the Old Testament? Well, it depends on what book you read, whose research you're trusting. Many of you have heard of Alfred Edersheim, the converted Jewish writer who has left with us some monumental works on the temple and on Judaism in the time of Christ. In the back of his book on the temple, he has an appendix listing all passages interpreted in ancient Jewish literature as a reference to the Messiah. In Jewish literature, he found 456 passages interpreted by the Jews in ancient Jewish literature as being a reference to the Messiah. Now, if you go over that list, that sounds rather impressive. You say, well, my goodness, if here are passages in pre-Christian Jewish literature referring to the Messiah, or at least literature that's very, very ancient among the Jews. Many of those passages, I think none of you in this room would probably agree, are really messianic in a technical sense of the word. I certainly don't see the Messiah in all of those passages. But it is a valuable listing. I don't know of any place else where you'd find a listing quite like this, and probably many of you have Edersheim's book in your library. Maybe you never noticed that appendix at the back. It is valuable to have that collection of passages, even though we might disagree with some of them. Barton Payne, in his book, The Encyclopedia of Biblical Prophecy, found 574 verses that he considered to be directly predictive of the Messiah in the Old Testament. Pearson, this isn't Larry from Albuquerque, lists 300 predictions, not necessarily verses, but specific items predicted about the Messiah. Now, my own research, for better or for worse, and I don't hold it up as the last word by any means, but it's, as I say, it satisfies me and probably no one else. I found 73, I believe I said last night in my message, talking off the top of my head, I'd forgotten about one of them. I found 73 passages involving about 604 verses that I would classify as referring directly to the personal Messiah. And I have to tell you that probably most of those, good many of those passages, a lot of people would disagree, very conservative people would disagree that these are referring to the Messiah. But I tried to maintain a rigorous set of hermeneutical principles to decide in each case whether in fact the passage was referring to the Messiah or to some other event along the way, person along the way. The starting point for the consideration of prophecy is the thought that God is omniscient, that God knows the future. Real prediction is found throughout the Bible. This is something that our liberal friends through the years have doubted. But according to Payne's calculation, you have at least 28, almost 29% of the Old Testament is predicted. And almost 22% of the New Testament. That sounds a little high to me, but that's based upon his research into the predictive character of both of the Testaments. Well, what I want to do is to look at some of the passages and just to kind of give an overview today. And I've listed not all of the 73 passages by any means, but several of the more prominent passages I've listed for you in your notes, just as a handy reference guide to you for your own personal study after the convention is over. And as I said, I don't have any illusions of trying to get through this entire group of prophecies. But I'd like to look at some of them with you. There was one that I want to make sure that I get in case we don't get quite that far. When you come, I already mentioned that in the Jewish literature immediately before the time of Christ, there's very little messianic fervor, really, that I've been able to identify at least. But all of a sudden, when you get to the first century, as testified by the New Testament, you have people very excited about the appearance of the Messiah. and apparently expecting him. When John the Baptist came, you remember they went out and asked him, are you the Messiah? Because I think his baptism, you know, Ezekiel and Zechariah both have prophecies that connect a water cleansing with the Messianic age. And when John came baptizing, I think they immediately assumed that he was making a claim to be the Messiah, so they sent out a committee to investigate the situation. But why the fervor in the first Christian century? And I was reading some Jewish books the other day, not written from our perspective at all, but from the Jewish perspective, and they cited a passage which I suppose we Christians ought to have taken note of a long time ago. Maybe you already have. I suspect maybe in New Mexico you're theologically advanced beyond what we are in Florida. But it seems like theology moves from California eastward. I don't know. It takes a while for it to get to Florida. But the passage is Daniel 9, 24 and 25. That's the famous 70 weeks passage. And we don't have the time to get into all the details in that passage. But the first part of the prophecy, I think, is relevant. I'd like to start out by sharing that with you. Gabriel is talking to Daniel there in that passage, and if I understand the passage correctly, and I may not, it's one of the quagmires of Old Testament interpretation, as one writer puts it. It's a difficult passage. But it seems to me that one of the things that is being said there by the angel is that it says, from the going forth of the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, until Messiah the Prince will be, in essence, 69 heptads of years. A heptad of years is a period of 7 years. So if we convert these heptads into actual years of time, we would have 483 years from the going forth of a command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince will be, in essence, 483 years, 69 heptads of years. Now, the problem has been in identifying what the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem really is. The commentators go into a whole series of possibilities. In my judgment, the place to start is by noticing that the word commandment here to restore and rebuild Jerusalem is the same Hebrew word used a few verses earlier in reference when the angel talks about God giving him instructions to come to Daniel. In other words, I think what we're dealing with here is a divine command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, not the edict of some Persian king. And the fourth chapter of the book of Ezra, if you'll turn over to the fourth chapter of the book of Ezra, I believe you can nail down the first attempt to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. This passage has generally been overlooked because most people assume that it was Nehemiah who rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem, and he certainly did, but he did not make the first attempt to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. In chapter 4, beginning in verse 7, we find that in the reign of the Persian king Artaxerxes, that some of the residents of that area were very concerned that the Jews who had come back recently were rebuilding the city. Look at verse 12. Let it be known to the king that the Jews who came up from you have come to us at Jerusalem. They are rebuilding the rebellious and evil city and are finishing the walls and repairing the foundation. Now, under the reign of this king Artaxerxes, there were two returns of the Jews that we know anything about. The one was in 457 under Ezra's leadership. The other return was a bit later under Nehemiah in 445 B.C. Now, we know that Nehemiah in 445 B.C. came back with permission to rebuild those walls of Jerusalem, and he finally carried that through to success. But here in this earlier return, apparently Ezra did not have the authority to rebuild those walls of Jerusalem. And yet they were making the attempt. And I would like to suggest to you that the decree referred to in the prophecy of Daniel chapter 9, verse 25, 24 and 25,
is the decree not of some Persian king, as most of the commentaries have suggested, but was actually a directive of Ezra himself, and Ezra being a man of God, communicating God's directive to these people. And so, starting from the return in 457, if you read the whole book of Ezra and Ezra's ministry, you'll find out he came back, he had a lot of problems. So in 457, or perhaps 1 year later in 456, the Jews, under Ezra's leadership, began to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. If you read the rest of the fourth chapter of Ezra, you'll see that the Persian king made them stop. Why? Because there was no authorization to rebuild the walls. Never mind that. The prophecy says, counting from the command or the word, literally the Hebrew word simply means the word to rebuild Jerusalem, will be 69 heptads of years, or 483 years. Now, even if you allow for any rounding off of numbers at all, I'm not sure you even need to do that in this particular case, but allowing for some minor degree of rounding off of numbers, which you sometimes have in biblical prophecy, that 483 years will bring you to the year that the New Testament chronologers assigned to the baptism of Jesus, when he appeared in November of the year 26 to be baptized by John the River Jordan and to commence his messianic ministry. Let me run that by you again. Daniel says 483 years, 69 heptads of years will elapse after the command to restore, or the word to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. Ezra 4 pinpoints that period to within a year or two. Counting from that period, 483 years, will bring you down to the year of the baptism of Jesus. Now, my research has indicated in history at least 42 people have claimed to be the Messiah. As far as I've been able to tell, Jesus was the first to make that claim. And I believe he did make that claim very clearly and many by implication and directly in other some places, that he was the Messiah. Of the 42, he's the only one who appeared and began his ministry in conjunction with the precision of this prophecy in Daniel chapter 9 and verse 25. I wanted to be sure to get this one in if we don't get any further today, because I think it helps to explain why the Jews of the first century were all of a sudden excited about the appearance of the Messiah. Their system of chronology was not as scientifically precise as ours is today, and so consequently they did not know exactly when to start counting these 69 heptads of years. But they knew it had to be soon. Several great Jewish rabbis argued publicly that the Messiah had to come during the period of the Second Temple, during that generation. Rabbi Akiva, to name one of them, was one of the most respected of the rabbis, and argued Messiah had to come during the period of the Second Temple. And when the temple was destroyed in 70 A.D., Rabbi Akiva was desperate. He had to look around and find a candidate to be the Messiah. And he chose an unlikely cuss by the name of Bar Kokhba to be the Messiah. But the point is that from their understanding of Daniel 9, and you can verify this in the literature, the Jewish literature on this passage, the conservative Orthodox Jewish literature, traditional Jewish literature, from their understanding of Daniel 9, they had concluded that the Messiah had to come during the days of the Second Temple. Now the temple is no longer there, and it is wishful fantasy on the part of our Jewish friends to be anticipating still the coming of a Messiah. He's already here. That's our proclamation. That is our message to the Jewish people. Now let's back up and get back on our outline. I just want to make sure I'm kind of going at this backward, but the whole stream, if you can liken messianic prophecy to like a river with various tributaries flowing into that river as time went on. It starts with a trickle in Genesis 3:15, a verse that is called by many scholars the Proto-Evangelium, which I believe is probably correct, the first gospel. That right there in the shadow of the Garden of Eden, God said to the serpent, actually, in the context of a curse upon the devil, God says that from the seed of woman will come one who will crush the head of serpents. Crush the devil's head. Now, there are many people that think that this is simply a verse that, in effect, the crusher is coming. The one who will give you victory over the devil and sin is coming into this world. And for several hundreds of years, I do not know how many years elapsed between creation and the flood. Now, I know that there are some who take the technique of adding up all the ages there in Genesis 5 and trying to compute that. I don't think that's a sound methodology, personally. If that's your methodology, I certainly believe at least that much time passed, but probably much more. But anyway, during that length of time, between the garden and the time of Noah, the only ray of hope in the darkness of sin was the thought the crusher was coming. When they sent their kids to camp in the summertime, they only had one chorus to sing. The crusher is coming. It's the name of the chorus. It's all the hope they had. The head of the devil is going to be crushed. The next prophecy along the way in Genesis is in 9:27. And here is a verse that could be, it's rather ambiguous in our English text and is in the Hebrew text too, for that matter. But he's been talking about how Yahweh will be the God of Shem. There'll be a special relationship between the Shemites and the God of redemption and salvation, the God Yahweh. That's the name of God reveals him in his role as Redeemer and Savior and Deliverer. And then he says something to the effect, well, let me get my Bible open. Somebody read it. Somebody has it there, read it.
9:27.
Well, I'll have it before you get there. May God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem. Now, you can see, obviously, we have a problem with a pronoun there in verse 27. Does the pronoun refer to the Japhethites coming and dwelling in the tents of the Shemites, or does the prophecy talk about God coming and dwelling in the tents of Shem? Now, one of the finest old works on Messianic prophecy that I know anything about is a work by Briggs from the last century. And he argues very strongly, and in my mind very cogently, that the hymn in verse 27 refers to the main subject of the verse, God, and not to Japheth. That the prophecy here is that someday God is going to come and dwell in the tents of Shem. Now, in either case, however you take the pronoun, you're dealing with a messianic prophecy. The only issue is it a personal messianic prophecy, or is it a general messianic prophecy looking forward to the union of Jews and Gentiles in the future? I believe it's personal. And that he's saying, in effect, that God is going to come and tabernacle among us, tent among us. And isn't it interesting? In the opening verses of the Gospel of John, that's exactly the language that is used. That the Word became flesh and tented, literally, tabernacled among us, tented among us. And I think perhaps John had this passage in mind. I can't prove it. It's not a direct quotation, but maybe just a coincidence. But it seems to fit. And so notice how the first two prophecies begin two major streams of prophecy. The one is the emphasis upon the humanity. See, in Genesis 3:15, there's no hint that the deliverer will be divine. He is of the seed of woman. As far as they knew, for several hundred years, all they could look forward to and think of would be some human being, some descendant of woman. Isn't it interesting? It says woman, not man. I think the virgin birth there is implied, not directly prophesied, but certainly implied. Seed of woman. But then when you get over to Noah's day and these last prophetic words of Noah, we now learn that at some point in the future, God himself is going to come and dwell amongst his people. And so now we have two streams that are going to start developing through the course of the history of the Old Testament. The one emphasizing the deity, the one emphasizing the humanity. And looking back, you see, as Christians, we can see the marvelous blending of those two streams in the person of Jesus Christ. Now when you come over to Genesis chapter 12 and verse 3, where we have here the words to Abraham, "In you and in your seed shall all families of the earth be blessed." And this is a marvelous promise and is quoted several times in the New Testament. And what we have here in this word seed is a word that has a little bit of ambiguity about it. Can be plural, can refer to seed, in other words, a person's entire progeny taken collectively, or can refer to one individual within that group. And so as the promise begins to unfold here to Abraham, in you and in your seed, you go through Genesis, God narrows this down. We're not talking about the promise coming through all of Abraham's descendants, but through Isaac and through Jacob, later to be known as Israel, and then eventually coming through a person, Christ. That's the way the apostles interpreted this promise to Abraham, that it involves the person of Christ. All nations blessed through Christ, and then blessed through Abraham's spiritual progeny, as Brother Montsmith emphasized last hour, where the blood relationship seems to be pushed into the background, and the faith relationship begins to stand out in the foreground, as he emphasizes that those of us who have faith in Jesus Christ are the true sons of Abraham in the world today. Well, the promise made to Abraham has several different facets to it. If you look at all these New Testament references that I've placed before you here on the transparency, you'll find out that the promise made to Abraham embraced all of these aspects. It embraced the birth of Christ. In Luke 1, 68 to 75, read those verses and see how he's interpreting the promise to Abraham as embracing the birth of Christ, as embracing the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, involved in the promise to Abraham, involving justification by faith, Galatians 3:8, involving the gift of the Holy Spirit, Galatians 3:14, involving the conversion of sinners, Acts chapter 3, verses 25 to 26. So in you and in your seed shall all nations of the earth be blessed. And the New Testament begins to be specific and to name these specific promises that are incorporated into this general promise made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob there in the book of Genesis. Well, again, we could spend probably half an hour in each one of these prophecies. We're just trying to sweep through here and give you a little bit of an overview. Another important prophecy as we come to the end of the book of Genesis is in the last words of Jacob. It seems like these patriarchs, as they approach death, were given prophetic insight into the future. We find that with Noah. We find that with Jacob. We find it later with Moses. It seems to be a characteristic. And in Genesis chapter 49, we find the first Old Testament name given to Messiah. Now, those of you who are serious students of the Old Testament, I'm sure will know from your study of this chapter that there are a multitude of interpretations of the word Shiloh in Genesis chapter 49. I'm of the opinion that Shiloh is a proper name. I realize that's not a very popular opinion among the scholars today, but I do believe that the Jews did take this as a personal messianic prophecy long before the time of Christ, and I believe that Shiloh is the first proper name in the Old Testament given to the coming one. See, back in Genesis 3:15, he's the crusher, but that word is not used in the text. In Genesis 9, he's the tent dweller. Genesis 12 and the rest of the patriarchal narrative, he's the one who brings the promises. But when we come to Genesis 49, the prophecy here is that the scepter, symbolizing the rule, the authority, the leadership, will not depart from the tribe of Judah until Shiloh comes, and then unto him, Shiloh, will be the obedience of the peoples. So that Judah will have tribal dominion among the tribes. And I think if you you don't have to know a lot of Bible history to know that the tribe of Judah was the tribal leader clear up through the time of David and through the Old Testament monarchy. And after the Jews came home from captivity, Judah was so dominant that they began to call the people the Jews. See, technically, the Jews are of the tribe of Judah. And so the tribe of Judah was dominant right up until the coming of Christ. And now, unto this Shiloh, this ruler, will be the obedience of people. World dominion. Now, implied in this passage, not directly taught, I think, but certainly implied, is that this Shiloh will be from the tribe of Judah. Now, that will come out, of course, much clearer as you move on through. You can't expect to find the whole gospel in some prophecy in the book of Genesis. You have to let time take its course. The stream gets wider and deeper as we move through the centuries of Old Testament history. At this early stage, we simply learn that a rest bringer, the word Shiloh means the rest bringer. And when Jesus said, "Come unto me, all you that labor and are heavy laden, I will give you rest." Hey, let me tell you something. He was not just speaking some sentimentality. He was making a messianic claim. And I have heard excellent New Testament expositors who taught on, "I will give you rest," who did not seem to know the Old Testament background of the rest bringer. And that's a concept, really, you can trace it even back beyond Shiloh and toward the in the days of Noah and on back. But the idea of someone who will bring rest. And here is Shiloh, the rest bringer, coming to have world dominion. Now, you see then, by the end of the time of Genesis, as we go through Genesis, we have four basic prophecies concerning the Messiah. Now, I'd like just quickly to refer to two other passages, and then maybe we'll open up for questions, since I guess I'm running out of time here. In Numbers chapter 24, I need the lights back on, please, just a second. This is one of the most amazing prophecies, and it comes from an unlikely source. It comes from Balaam the hypocrite, Balaam the two-faced prophet, and he's not a very worthy character to talk about. But I want you to see this prophecy. It's in Balaam's fourth oracle. And in verses 15 and 16, Balaam here is making a claim to speak by inspiration of God. If you read those verses carefully, he says the oracle, that's a word implying direct communication from God. The one who hears the words of God and knows the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty falling down yet having eyes uncovered. He's in a kind of a trance state as he looks into the future. Now notice what he says. "I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. I see someone in the future, not in the close future, but in the distant future, not now. A star shall come forth from Jacob. A scepter shall rise from Israel, and shall crush through the forehead of Moab, and tear down all the sons of Sheph, and Edom shall be a possession. Seir, its enemies, also shall be a possession, while Israel performs valiantly." The context here is, of course, where Balaam was brought in to curse the people of God, put the whammy on them, and God wouldn't let him do that. And so Balaam, before he leaves, says, "Let me pull back the curtain and show you what I see in the future about this people. He's coming, the star and the scepter. The star and the scepter. A royal ruler is coming from among these people. And this royal ruler will be victorious over all of the enemies of his people. He'll crush the skulls of the enemies of his people." At this particular moment in history, Edom and Moab were the chief enemies of God's people. And so he uses their names in the prophecy to indicate that all enemies, they stand for all of the enemies that will be overcome by this ruler. Now, remember what he said back in verse 17, "I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. And then we look down in verse 20. We need a lot more time to talk about these things. I just have a chance to outline it. I've never seen a commentary that drew the connection between verses 20 and 25 through 25 and the prophecy of Balaam. He looked at Amalek and took up his discourse, and he said Amalek was the first of nations, powerful nation in Balaam's day. But his end shall be destruction. When is this star and scepter going to arise? Well, Amalek won't be around when he arises. And he looked at the Kenite and he took up his discourse and he said, your dwelling place is enduring, your nest is set in the cliff. Nevertheless, Cain shall be consumed. How long shall Assyria keep you captive? When is the star and the scepter going to arise? Not before the Assyrian captivity, which commenced in 745 B.C. Then he goes on to say, verse 24, but ships shall come from the coast of Kittim, way out in the Mediterranean Sea. And they shall afflict Assyria, that is the Mesopotamian power, and shall afflict Eber. So here you have the ships from Kittim, and again, what might they be if not the invasion of the armies of the Greeks who came from those far distant places in the west to the Hebrew mind. Kittim was about as far west as you could go. Here came the Greeks to conquer the Mesopotamian powers. And then he comes on down, the next last line of verse 24, and they, I take that to be a reference to the Greeks, shall also come to destruction. When is this star and scepter going to arise? Well, Amalek will be destroyed first. The Assyrian captivity will take place. Then the Greeks are going to come and conquer the Mesopotamian powers, and they too will fall. Now, who followed the Greeks?
Rome.
Now, is it any coincidence, then, that the wise men of the Magi of Matthew, who were from the same region of Balaam, saw a strange star in the sky, realized that this had to be the time, and began to pursue that star to the manger in Bethlehem? Hear me now. I'm not suggesting that verse 17 is prophesying the star in the sky. What I'm saying is that those fellows were wise enough to realize that when they saw this strange star in the sky in the days of the Roman Empire, they remembered the passage about the star and the scepter from Balaam's mouth and pursued that star, as you know the story of Matthew, to Bethlehem's manger. Now, one other. How's my time doing? I only have 1 minute.
Oh, you can take three or four.
1 minute. Whatever it takes. One more passage. I want to get through the Pentateuch. You say, I know there are many other passages, but you've heard Isaiah 53 and all of... Okay.
If you want to leave, you can.
One other. This is in Deuteronomy 18, where Moses is giving the prophecy about God raising up a prophet like unto himself. Now, you follow the verses. I've given them there to your notes, and I'm running out of time here. But if you look at Deuteronomy 18... is prophecy about the prophet. Now, we've seen the prophecy that he's going to be divine. God's going to dwell in the tents of Shem. We've seen the prophecy that he's going to be a ruler. Unto him will be the obedience of all the peoples. I haven't gotten a chance to get to the basic passage that talks about him being the priest. That's what I call my burger chef special. I wanted to share that with you today, and now you'll never get to hear it. But anyway, here's the one about him being a prophet. And in Deuteronomy 18, it talks about his Hebrew birth, raise up a prophet from among your brethren, his fullness of divine communication, I will speak to this prophet, he'll speak to you, he will faithfully tell you all that I tell him, and he will institute a new covenant. I get that from the fact that Moses was the institutor of a covenant. This prophet will be like Moses, as being a covenant institutor, other ways like Moses too. And the passage also spells out the duty of all men to obey this coming prophet. Now, I realize that most of the commentaries suggest that Deuteronomy 18 is establishing the prophetic office in the Old Testament. I don't believe that for a minute, simply for many reasons, but the simplest reason is because there already was a prophetic office from the very foundation of the earth. I think this is a personal messianic prophecy. It's quoted in the New Testament as such. and applied to Christ, and it establishes the fact that the coming Messiah will be prophet. Now I've got one more thing to show you that'll kind of summarize everything we put together here. Let's kind of put it together. As we go through the periods that we've gone through now in the Pentateuch, in the Adamic period, the earliest period, we have the idea that the Messiah will be human, coming from the seed of woman. From the days of Noah, the idea he will be divine, dwelling in the tents of Shem. From the patriarchal period, we have two results of his coming. One will be a blessing to the nations. The other will be that he will have authority over the nations as Shiloh. Two results of his coming. In the Mosaic period, we have two functions of the coming one depicted. He will be a king crushing through the enemies of God's people. He will be a prophet who will give us God's complete and final revelation, to whom we all are responsible to obey. So we start here, finding the Messiah to be the seed of woman. Could be any person, born of Eve, a descendant of Eve. Could be anybody. That's narrowed down in Genesis 9 to the Shemite race of people. That's narrowed down later in Genesis to the line of Abraham, then to Isaac, then to Jacob. And finally, by the end of Genesis, it's narrowed down to the place where the Messiah apparently is to come from, the tribe of Judah. Right here in the Pentateuch, enormous amount of bedrock foundational prophecy concerning the coming of Christ. Well, follow through on your own in the outline. Want to get my book or some other book on the subject, why I think that you would find some very helpful things there. I'll be glad to hang around and answer questions if any of you want to stay, but I think we need to officially dismiss so that you might feel free to go about your business if you choose. Let's have an official dismissal prayer, and then we'll discuss, if you want to discuss some things. Some of you, I know, are just anxious to nail me to the wall, and that's amazing. Father, I thank you for your word. I thank you for the fact that we Christians believe Jesus is the Messiah, and that our faith is based upon a tremendous testimony from the ancient testament. And we pray, Father, that our faith will be strengthened by being in workshops like this one and others that are being conducted during this convention, that we might realize that our faith rests upon a solid rock. Pray in Jesus' name. Amen.